Hey, everybody. My name is Benoit, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. Hi, y'all. I certainly want to thank the committee for inviting me, and Judy, God bless her heart. I listen to her whine a lot. She started whining about all the speakers changing and switching, and some canceled, and she was out scrambling, and she didn't know what to do with this and that and the other. And I guess this was Thursday afternoon. And I said, well, you're lucky that I'm okay. I've just been sick for several days, but I'm fine. And about an hour later, y'all know what the Green Apple Quick Steps, I know you do. Y'all know what Green Apple Quick Steps is? It's when you don't know whether to sit on the pot or puke in the pot, you know. And I had that hit me. And I called Judy and I said, you know, I am really sick and there's no way I can get on that plane in the morning and I am really, really sorry. And I could just hear this. And I told her to call me and I'd see if I could get myself together. There's about 30 of us went up to Lake Arrowhead up in the mountains in California last weekend, and we come down that hill, and people just started falling off right and left. There were six of us that I know of as of Tuesday that had this stuff, so somebody was a carrier, and I really want to know who it was, I'll tell you. I sat in there about 2 a.m., I guess it would be Friday morning, and I had the trash can in front of me, and I was sitting on the commode, and I was, thought came to me. You know, I hear alcoholics talking about this, doing this all the time. And after what I went through for 3 days, I mean, I'll kill the person who get. I can't even imagine going out the next night and doing it all over again. That's sick. I mean, geez, you know what's causing it, and you go do it again. I just kept thinking, boy, that's so sick. And sponsorship is a good thing, as she was mentioning, because I called my sponsor yesterday morning and was whining to her about what was going on and that I was feeling better, but, you know, not 100%, blah, 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 and the trouble that Judy had been through and what was going on. And she gets real quiet as she can do from time to time, and I knew she's thinking. And she said, well, if I was you, maybe I'd just try to kind of push myself a little and see if you can't go on, because if you stay at home, you'll probably get to feeling better tomorrow and you'll go have fun, then you'll feel guilty. So I pushed myself on the plane at midnight last night. I took the red eye here, so I haven't had much sleep. Now, this is a sad story, I want y'all to know. I hadn't slept in 3 or 4 days because of the Green Apple Quick Steps, and no sleep last night. And I think I'm really pitiful. I did a great job staying awake for everybody today. I mean, y'all were so interesting that I really wanted to see how sick y'all were and how it was going to turn out. But I do thank you for having me. I think I really and truly consider it an honor. I mean, really and truly, it's an honor. And as the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, and I'm a student of it, it is a privilege to stand at this podium. I consider it holy ground. I truly do. I think what goes on up here has nothing to do with me or any of these other speakers. I know some of them very well, and they're just not that smart, you know. Sorry. And something happens up here that just is really incredible. So as myself personally, I really want to thank you for inviting me. And as an Al-Anon, I really want to thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for sharing your podium with us. It's mighty important to me. If you have trouble remembering my name, my husband said, if you'll take the V away and remember annoy. And I remind those who think that's so cute that he's dead now. He better hide out. I came into this magnificent fellowship of ours February the 7th of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas. My home group for many, many years was the Central Group. My home group now is the Stepped Up Group. Mondays and Thursday nights, we're right by LAX, so if you ever fly into Los Angeles, let me know and I'll scoop you up and take you to our meeting. My committed open AA meeting is on Wednesday nights at Pacific Group, and I'm at those three nights all the time. You can catch me there. And another old Texas saying, Polly will know this, maybe one or two of you. You know, I feel right now just like as important as tits on a boar hog. I mean, would any of y'all like to trade places with me after you've heard all these magnificent speakers all day? I mean, what am I going to say? I mean, it's all been said. I feel very lame up against most of them. I mean, and Jennifer, God. If you didn't hear that Alateen speaker, if you can ever get a tape from those losers over there. She was magnificent. I mean, she just made my pitiful trip worth it just to hear that young lady. What a message she had. And I know all these speakers, and they outdid themselves. I'm part Indian. My dad is from Oklahoma, Choctaw Indians, and he was uneducated. A wonderful, quiet, quiet man. He just held his head down and just walked. He just walked life. He married my mother, who came from the Southern Baptist. My grandmother was a Methodist dropout, so she was even, you know, she was just, her whole family just turned their back on my grandmother because she quit going to Methodist and went to them. And plus, she had a habit of marrying alcoholics. And I did not know this until just a few years ago. I finally put it together. You know, it's like, duh. She was married three times, and they were all alcoholics. And if you know, I mean, way back then, they did not get divorces. I mean, it just wasn't done. So my mother came from a divorced family, and she was full of shame and never held her head up either. And they met, married, and had three brothers and myself, and they were just good, hardworking Texas people. You know, they're just good people. And when I was a little girl, my oldest brother broke his neck. We were in Oklahoma on a vacation and left him paralyzed, and it broke my father. And I remember when I was a kid, the Lubbock Avalanche Journal had a, on the front of it, bottom of the page, a picture of my brother in his hospital bed, and it says, my dad was standing at the foot of the bed, and it said, Father swallows pride and asks for help. And so we were getting donations from people all over Lubbock County. We didn't have insurance. I don't even know if there's insurance back there. I guess it was, but I sound like I'm really old, don't I? And we were getting all this money from just good people. And then I put my head down because it was like we're different and we're charity people and we have to take from other people. And we were all kind of, everybody in my family was uneducated. And it was just, you were just different. And I was full of shame and low, low self-worth, as they say. And I just kept to myself and kept real quiet. And my house was not a fun place. My brother, God love his heart, he just smelled bad. He had rotting flesh. There wasn't these striker frames. And he lay there and just had rotting flesh. And the medicine that they put on that smelled worse than the rotting flesh. And the things that he had to do, his other body functions, just smelled really bad. The house just reeked of it. And so I never had anybody at my house. I stayed out in the streets all the time. Never came home. Unless it was absolutely necessary. And I started running around with the older crowd, probably 10, 11, 12, something like that. And they had magazines and stuff, and they'd show me things that was really, life was really exciting out there. And there was a Life magazine, and it had a picture of dances and stuff. And I was just enthralled with it. I just wanted to go where that was. It just looked magical to me. And then when I got up a little older, one of the older girls, I think she was 17 or 18, took me to my first honky-tonk. It was a cotton club. met a guy, Jim, Mary's husband, has been to the Cotton Club in Lubbock, Texas. And one of the first people I saw out there was Elvis Presley. And my friend's name was Sandra. And I don't know why I'm telling you this. It doesn't have anything to do with anything, but Sandra went up to Elvis, and I was standing beside her. And, I mean, she was pretty snockered, I imagine, because she just... and I don't mean to be disrespectful of the crowd or anything, but she just pulled out her breast and had him sign his name on her breast. And I thought that was the coolest thing. I mean, just yank that thing out and say, here, just stuck up there and say, here, sign it. And she's still written up. if there's anything about Elvis, I was in Graceland just a while back, and they had a little article in the paper about Sandra. I was there. It was just very touching. One of the things that I learned at those honky-tonks, you know, I'm a fast learner, and I watch and see what happens, and I don't make a move till I know what you're supposed to be doing. I'm a manipulator, and I'm a controller, and I have to know best. I have this strong need to know best, and change things. If you'll notice, I moved the table. It just drove me crazy all day long. The table was way over there, and, you know, you couldn't get your water, and I just couldn't wait to get up here to change the whole podium, you know. I do.
I say she always does that.
I do. I mean, I want it convenient for me. And y'all, most times, don't know how to do it. And Polly referred to alcoholism today. And the isms is what make up an alcoholic, I understand. And I've been a student of Clancy ever since I walked in. He was my husband's sponsor. And he and I have gotten to arguments about Al-Anon isms and alcohol isms. And my great-great-grandsponsor made a list one time of Al-Anon isms, if you will. And part of that is control and manipulation and the need to be right and the blame and the complain and the martyr. Don't cover his ears up. Look at her. What are you doing, girl? Listen. And I just eat up with all of them. I truly am. And I get out to this honky-tonk, and I was watching what happens. And this will describe every honky-tonk I've ever been in. All the gals stay on this side of the room, and all the guys stay on this side of the room at the bar. And the music's going, it's pretty lame, you know, it's about 11-ish. And at 11-ish, the guys over here are getting pretty happy and kind of loose. And they'll start swaggering. I love alcoholic swaggers. I mean, they just can swagger, you know. Just... You're gonna dance, babe, you know. It's like... Jim Williams used to say that if you lined up 10 pretty girls against the wall, that he would pick the sickest one every time. And I told Jim one time, you haven't figured out yet, son, the sickest of that 10 takes one step forward. You never picked them at all. We just let you think that you picked them. Because I'm studying the bar, and, you know, I love bars. I love AA meetings. My AA meeting, committed AA meeting, there's 1,200 people there every Wednesday night. Many of you have been there. And they'll say, are there any alcoholics in the room? And every time they do that, I'm just, oh. I'm just like, oh. I mean, I love alcoholics. I just love them. I mean, just, man, there's just something about them. And so I've already picked out the one that I think's the cutest and the most can swagger the best and the best dancer. And so I've already picked him up. So about 11-ish. As he comes over with his little swagger, I'm moving a little bit forward, giving that look. But who was it that's saying, snagger? Snagging? Oh, honey, I'm a snagger from way back. And then you dance a little while, and then you got to be really quick at closing time. I mean, that last dance. God, that last dance. In Texas, they play, and especially ones I went to, I wound up in a place called the Bloody Bucket. And it's, Jim was there, and he said, I remember going to this one place that they pad you down before you come in. I said, yeah, that's the bloody bucket. And they would play Sleepwalk. And it's a musical. It's a guitar musical, steel guitar. And it just vibrates your whole soul. I mean, it is just so magnificent. I just get cold chills thinking about it. It just, oh, man. It goes, if I can do this. I've been sick, you know. Doesn't that just get to you? I mean, and I got my hymn of the night picked out, and I'm really quick at that last song, and I got it. And we're out there dancing, and I mean, you couldn't put a human hair in between our bodies. I mean, we are clutched up, you know. And that song's going on, and all of a sudden he gets right here, just right here in this ear, and he's saying the magic words to me. I mean, they're magic. They fix me. I fill up. I'm a different human being. I heard a speaker from AA say this AA podium one time, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. He's talking about what filled him up was a drink, that he felt useless and worthless. He had no self-worth. He took his drink, and it came down, and it went boom. And then it comes back up, and it fills his shoulder up with muscles, and his arms pop out and just feel like a man. He could just go do anything. And he just swelled up and he was saying it. And I thought, I identify with that. I know exactly what he's talking about. I know exactly the first time I ever felt it and how I felt many years after that. It's at that magical moment when they're right here and they're nibbling. And he says, sugar, I need you. Oh, man. I'm full. I'm whole. I am beauty. I am woman. I am everything that you can dream of. At that moment, he is mine. And I'm going to give him the wonders of the world. He is going to be so happy. And I take him to my house and I do everything I heard the big girls do. You see, he's going to be it. He's going to fix me. And there's nothing as slippery as an alcoholic the morning after. I mean, they're so slippery. And I know I'm already, man, I am on my way skidding down to hell. Because I sat in that same church that Polly did, and that same preacher banging on that table, screaming, these veins popping, his red stains, sin, 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 and I knew I was doomed. But, it, you know, it just didn't seem that darn bad. So I go back out the honky-tonk again. And I know exactly what an alcoholic means when they say, tonight I'm just going to go out to the bar and have a couple of drinks, and then I'm going to go home to my family. I'm just going to have a couple of beers. I know exactly what they're talking about, and then they wind up, you know, gone for days. Because I said the same thing to myself. Tonight, I'm just going to go out there and dance. That's all I'm going to do. I'm not going to do anything else. I'm not going to pick up anybody. Nobody's coming home with me. I'm not going home with anybody. I have got to straighten my life out. This is bad. I am going to hell. And I've got to stop this. And it would come, and I just couldn't leave. I mean, I just couldn't leave. There was this big giant hole in my soul and in my gut, and it would become closing time, and then I'd be filled up and round, round, round. I just turned out to be a slut puppy hoe. I tore my dignity little strip at a time and, you know, just gave it away. I used to think I was such a victim until I got here and heard that there are no victims, they're volunteers. And I did it to myself. There's a line in the big book that just popped in there not too long ago. I don't know when they stuck it in there, but it said that we are our own self-imposed crisis. And I thought, you know, that's right. Everything I ever did was self-imposed. There is no blame. There is just no blame. I was as goofy and sick as you can possibly make them. And my sponsor said, you know, you can't blame any alcoholic. You were a squirrel always looking for a tree to climb up. You just were. And I've had three major alcoholics and a bunch of minor ones in between. And they just do something for me. I mean, I can't imagine. I dated this one time, this guy, he was normal. And I'm telling you, it was the most boring couple of dates I've ever had in my life. I mean, they came on time, had a rose, took me out to eat. They paid for it. We went to a movie. He held my hand, took me home, walked me to the door, kissed me on the cheek, and said he'd call me. And he did. Now, what's the fun in that? I mean, there's no challenge whatsoever. My first major alcoholic, I found out the bloody bucket, and he was a gangster, gambler. He was a professional gambler and a bootlegger. That's how he made his living. And I truly didn't realize how I had slowly slipped and slipped and slipped and slipped till the people that I was around, most people would not be around. Most, and I want to say decent people, that's what they called them back then. Most decent people wouldn't be with these people. And that's where I wound up and felt very comfortable with these people. They were they call them boosters. They were shoplifters and pimps and prostitutes, gamblers, bootleggers, just whatever you can imagine they were there. And then there was me. And I just always thought I was so much better than they were. God love them. And I had, I could share with them from time to time. And I just fit there. I just fit there for some reason or other. Now, I drank. I'm like Mary. I drank too. But I do not have the allergy to the body. A lot of the isms I have that are like alcoholics, as far as I can tell, except the depth of them. My daughter says, it's like this, Mom. When you have a flat tire, you call AAA. When I have a flat tire, I have to call suicide prevention. And that makes sense to me, because that's what I do. And she just goes bonkers. When I say I'm fear, an alcoholic, as far as I can tell, is in stark terror. So we have the same emotions, but it's like, again, just my observation from the crazy kids I've got. Their nerves are like they lay on top of the skin. Mine are buried with this cable about 4 inches deep inside my body so that you can't touch my nerves, my emotions, my feelings, and theirs are out here. So I think that's the difference along with the allergy. So I drank for a long time, and this guy was just nuts. I mean, he was crazy, and there was guns around the house and shot at people. He shot at me. He pistol whipped me. He threw me in and out of moving cars. I mean, we just fought all the time, and it was pitiful. I learned after I got here maybe to try to keep my mouth shut. What a concept. I never even thought about it. You have to get their attention, and you have to explain things when they're not doing right, you know, and then explain to you. And I moved in with this man. I became pregnant by this man, unmarried. It never occurred to me to say to him, let's get married and give this child a decent start in life. It never even occurred to me to do that, because at this time in my life, I knew I was a piece of garbage and not anybody was going to, you know, put up with that. And so I never even considered asking him. He took care of me until I had my daughter. And then he told me in the hospital that he had done all he was going to do, and that I would have to make my own way now. And he'd give me a couple hundred dollars to get started. And he walked out. And one of the other isms of an Al-Anon is called vindictiveness. I don't particularly like that word. I think a better way to explain that is, if you've hurt me, I need to show you the weight and the depth of this pain by showing you some pain. That's what I call it. So I was going to show him what he had lost and how bad he was going to feel when he saw me with this one particular man that he absolutely hated. Just hated him. They were just enemies. So I manipulated and maneuvered and got with this other guy and saw that he had plenty to drink. You know, I always did that. I always griped when they were drunk at the wrong time. But when I needed them to do something, then I would pour them a little bit stronger drink. I'd pour them a couple of drinks quicker than what they normally do. It took me a long time in inventories to see my part, that I was giving them the poison when it suited me. And I am not proud to say that at all. But I manipulated this and got him drunk one night quicker than normal and took him out to the Bloody Bucket. flaunted myself in front of my daughter's daddy and left quickly. And a couple of days later, he took a shotgun and blew this man's head off. Now, I never, ever expected that to happen. Not ever. It just, that happens in movies. It doesn't happen in real life. And I was just blown away by it. My friend came. It was real early in the morning. The sun was coming up. And she came and knocked on the door, and she told me what just happened. And I remember standing there thinking, because my chest started getting very tight, my throat started closing, I was having a tough time breathing, and it seemed like the sun was going back down. I was thinking, now how can the sun be going back down? Where's it going? And this pain was filling me up. And I thought, oh, my God, this pain. And I can't stand this. I'm not going to have this uncomfortableness in me. And I just decided at that point to stuff that feeling. It was too tough. And that was my first encounter that I brought up in inventories of me stuffing a feeling. And it went down deep and buried very deep. And I put my shoulders back and I said, that's too bad. And it came out in newspapers and everything, and they were making a big deal out of it. And my parents, well, they were so fed up with me at this point. I had a child out of wedlock, and then this happened. And I went over to my mother's house, and she said to me, she met me at the door, and she said, I would like for you to leave. I don't want you coming in and out of here anymore. I just don't want our neighbors to see you here. And if anybody asks if you're our daughter, please tell them that you're not. She was a big member of the Rebecca Lodge, and she had been voted this high mucky muck at state. And when all this happened, they asked her to step down because of what I had done. And I felt real bad about that, and I knew she was right. And I said, you're right, Mama. I'll leave. And my dad used to come get my daughter and take her back over there. But my mother, she never laid eyes on me for quite some time, a couple of years. But I decided that what was going on with me was just awful, and I had to change. I just absolutely had to change my lifestyle. Now, I knew my grandmother believed in God. I did not. I'd seen an article in a magazine that said God is dead. One of the girls, just side note here, one of the girls, my grand sponsorees, 4 or 5 months ago, slipped this magazine under my chair at the meeting. She said, give me a little note. She said, you talked about this first time I ever heard an Al-Anon speaker, and I wanted you to have this magazine. So she got on the internet and dug out this magazine. It was back in the 40s. It was incredible. I was so thrilled to read it. And I just figured that, you know, and the Bible said they lived a long time back then, so maybe there was somebody and he lived a long time and was really good, and that's the kind of way I thought it really may have gone down. So I had nothing to turn to. So I knew I had to change my lifestyle. So what I did was go up the rodeo grounds. Now, at that time, cowboys weren't burning the flags and tearing up the draft cards and all that. And they'd say, these are real men and they're real citizens. And I thought, that made me feel good when they were saying that. So I decided I'd get a cowboy. That would fix me. And I did. And, you know, the difference in the honky-tonk and cowboy land is, after the rodeo, there's a slab of concrete with a fence around it. And all the girls lean up against this fence, and all the cowboys lean up against that fence. It's the only difference. And they played sleepwalk. And I picked out the bull rider, the best bull rider of the bunch, and positioned myself where he would see me. I heard this girl, this alcoholic woman, speak just not too long ago. It just absolutely tickled me to death. She said, and I never had such a good idea. I'm sorry I didn't think about it. When she was at the bars, she would see where the men's restroom was. And she would find the table and set herself right in front of the door. So when they opened the door, the light from the bathroom would fall on her. She'd be sitting there. That is such a great idea. So we went round and round and did the deal, and one night he was drinking, and we was at that honky-tonk, and he was poking me in the chest, and I picked up a quart beer bottle. It was empty, and broke it upside of his head, just busted up. I'd done that several times. I don't know why I did things like that. You made me mad. I just busted in the head with a chair or something. And he just went to his knees, and I thought it'd be a good time to exit, and I did, and he chased me out the car, and he spun me around. And he got me by the shoulder, and I thought, boy, he is fixing to knock me cold turkey. And he said, I think you just knocked some sense in me. I think we should get married. Well, he had a quart bottle of salted, no, a gallon jug that he mixed salted off. I filled it up that night, and it stayed full till we was married. 2-3 days later, as soon as I could get him married, and he didn't draw a sober breath, I was afraid he'd change his mind. And then, do you understand, I was married. Now, this was something that was not a dream that I even entertained at all, because good girls get married, and I was not a good girl. And I was married. Now, this is going to be it. Life's going to be done. This is it. And I did all the things that a wife's supposed to do. I cooked him, you know, breakfast and made him little sandwiches and put little love notes in the sandwich. And so when he took a bite of it, the boys would say, "Oh, you got such a good wife." And I had him supper ready, his bath drawn. And I mean, I was an excellent wife. And we had an excellent marriage for 6 days. And and then he was off and running, and he didn't come home for a couple of days, and then it started. You know, it was all back. It was all back. I had, you know, loser up here, loser, loser. And I took my position at the window and watching, you know. You were talking about loneliness, Don. Loneliness just, I think it's all over alcoholism, whether it be the alcoholic or whether it be the family. It's just a nasty time. And I'd be saying that window, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, listening, because his pickup had a certain ding-dang, ding-dang. You know, I could hear it 5 miles down the road. And I'd watch for that pickup and listen for that pickup. And just, my life was waiting on pickup most of the time. I'd look up down the street and everybody else's lights were off. The cars were in the driveway. The pickup was out front. And standing there thinking, what in the world is wrong with me? Why am I unlovable? What is it? I don't understand. Everybody else can seem to do it, and I just can't. I don't know what the deal is. And he'd come in, and of course I'd run, jump in bed, and cling to the side of the bed like I was asleep. Learn how to breathe just like you're sleeping. He'd say, "You sleep?" I wouldn't say anything. "Are you mad?" "No, you know, just hurt." And then we'd go. You know, then we'd go at it. And it was the same thing all the time. We'd either fight a little bit or fight large, or you'd start breaking windows, throwing furniture, screaming, yelling, throwing me out the door, throwing him out the door. And my children, you know, God love them. I think Jennifer touched me so much because she was thrown out of the house. My kids were thrown out of the house, and Daddy screamed and yelled and broke things of theirs and broke things of mine. And it's a nasty disease. I love alcoholics, but I absolutely detest alcoholism. I hate it. And that's why I have to stay here and work as hard as I do to separate the two, because I love the alcoholic and I hate the disease. And I did that just as long as I could possibly do it. And the beatings were going, you know, if he didn't start a fight, I did. And I was beat up all the time. And the children had to watch that. And it was just, it was very, very sick, as you can well imagine. One Thursday, I woke up and I had 2 black eyes and a busted lip. And he was going to come in the next day. He was working out of town. He was going to come in the next day, and I knew I just couldn't do it. I could not do it one more time. Those kids were in the back room, and I was just thinking about those kids. You know, they both got different daddies, and by this time, my daughter's father, he was in prison for that murder. My son had this drunk for a daddy that beat us all up, and they were back there hiding, and they weren't particularly hiding from the alcoholic either. They had to hide a lot from me, because I would go absolutely crazy, and you can't grab the disease. You can't grab the alcoholic when he's out at the honky-tonk, but you can grab those kids. And you can scream at those kids. My kids suffered a lot under my hand, I'll tell you. And I just knew I couldn't do it anymore. And so I picked up the Yellow Pages. And the reason I did that in the fall of 68, I think it was October, November, Ann Landers had a letter in there from a woman who was asking what to do about a drunk husband. And I could have written that letter. And she told her, I thought, she said, to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's what I did. And this man gave me another number. I called it and went over to this woman's house. And she and her husband sat and talked to me for a long, long time. And then they made arrangements to and picked me up and took me to my first meeting. My very first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. He opened the door to the clubhouse, and he opened it and stepped back and looked at me, and I was looking at him because I really didn't know what he was doing. I wondered why he didn't go on in. And he was being a gentleman. Now, I had not encountered a gentleman in my whole life. Nobody had ever opened a door for me, so I wasn't quite sure, other than seeing it in movies, what was going on. Then he finally said, please, and just kind of bowed, and it dawned on me. He's opened this door for me. And I walked in the door, and it was a long coffee room. And at the end of the coffee room was a cigarette machine. Y'all remember those old machines where you put the money in and pull the thing, and it'd fall out, and each little company had their advertising on there, and it's all different kind of lights and colors, and it was really a pretty glow. And the guys were leaning against that machine, and that glow was coming up in their face, and they were laughing. And I can still see it and hear it right this moment. They were laughing a real, real belly laugh, and it was real. And I just stopped because I hadn't heard that in so long. You know, laughter leaves the alcoholic home. I love what Albert used to say. He was an Alateen sponsor, and one of the Alateens got in the car one night, and Albert says, well, son, how's it going? He said, well, the house sounds okay. He said, sounds? What do you mean? He started talking about the sounds of alcoholism. If it's quiet, it's an okay time. But if it's noisy, then it's not a good old time. And how his dad's voice, and I thought, yeah, that's right. The sounds of alcoholism is a strange sound. I went into that Al-Anon meeting, and I can't tell you what they said. I have no idea what they said. I get so tickled that people who say from time to time, I just talked to a girl the other day, and I said, oh, crap, you don't remember what it was like when you was new. She'd say, well, if that was going on when I was a newcomer, I would just left. No, you wouldn't. You don't even remember what was going on when you was a newcomer. Quit saying that. You know, I mean, nobody knows what's going on when they first get here. But if I was new, I'd leave. I just remember how I felt when I left there. That's what caught me. And whatever I felt, I knew I wanted some more of it. And I kept going back. And sometime later, I was given this book called The Prophet by Cahil Gibran. And there's a line there that says, say not that God is in your heart, but that you are in the heart of God. And I thought, that's it. That describes what happened to me. I stepped into that room, and there's a spirit that's in every meeting that I've ever been to. Sometimes I'm too tired to really experience it, but it's always there. Ramona, one of the old-time Al-Anon speakers from Oklahoma, she said all the time, if you'll just be still in a meeting sometime, and just be still, you will feel the spirit. She was an Indian, too, and she talked about God's spirit, the Creator's spirit going from one heart to the other and how it just pulled everybody together. And I believe that's true. And like I said, the only time I don't feel it is when I'm tired or blaming somebody. And I knew I wanted to come back, and I did. I would go in there real quick and leave real quick. And what time did we start? I have no idea. Does anybody know? Thank you. Okay. Now I forgot where I was. What? Oh, yeah, spirit. And somebody's listening. Thank you. I figure most of you are asleep. I'm just having a good time up here all by myself. You know? And I would listen to what they were saying, and I figured out pretty soon that they were getting too intimate for me. I figured out that they talked about God, and I didn't want any part of God. And then I heard, you know, just take what you like and leave the rest. And so I would slip in just the minute the meeting started. I mean, they just said, let's start. And I'd slip in that back door and set the back seat. And as soon as amen, I was out of there. Mainly because everybody looked like y'all did tonight. Clear eyes. You know, that eyes of recovery and the laughter and the joy was there, and I just knew that I didn't fit there, but I wanted to be back there and just observe you. If I could just sit back there and observe you, that would be enough for me. So I would just slip in and out, and they were watching me. They knew I was new, and I never could figure out how they knew I was new for quite some time. And it was two doors to that room, and one got at one door and one got at the other door before they started the Lord's Prayer so they could catch me, because I'd been there long enough now that they need to set the hook. And the door that I chose that night, my soon-to-be sponsor was standing there, and she caught me, and she was telling me a few little things about herself that she said she was surprised that she was telling them as they were coming out of her mouth, because it was stuff that she didn't share. And now I know why she did that. It was a divine appointment. I believe in divine appointments here. I believe God's timing is perfect. It's never a minute or a second too quick or too late. Because if she hadn't said those things, I never would have approached her. Because she looked so sweet. I'm pretty sure she never had said shit in her whole life, you know. And she said some things to me that I knew it would be safe to talk to her. And the next day she showed up at where I worked. I worked in a drugstore, and she'd come out there, and she slipped a $10 bill in my hand. Now, that was a lot of money back then, a lot of money. And I hadn't told anybody anything about my finances. There was no money, and there was no food at home. And the alcoholic had been gone for a while, and I didn't know where he was. And I tapped out my boss just as mad as much as I could. You know how people start looking at you after a while when you borrow money, and you come in with black eyes, and you've got all this makeup on, and they say, why do you stay there? And I always said, well, I'm leaving as soon as those kids, I've gone. As soon as the car paid, I'm out of here. As soon as I get some money saved up, as soon as. Now, I didn't know, have any more idea than they did why I stayed. I had no idea. So I didn't want to ask my boss, and I was really worried about actually having supper that night for my children and gas to get back and forth to work. There was just nobody to ask anymore. My friends were gone. I had two friends left, and they were really shaky. No family left. I mean, I was literally by myself with this disease. And when she handed me that $10 bill, I mean, I was just shocked. And I said, oh, I'll pay you back. She said, no, you don't. The way we do it here is that you pass that on, and God will bless you, and He will multiply it. And that was 32 years ago. And I've been passing that $10, because I mean, I just worried about it, and there was pretty soon that I had some money, and there was a gal who needed some money, and I just gave her some $10. I said, pass it on, don't give it back to me. And I wanted it out of my. And she moved to Phoenix shortly after, and then she sent me a card and sent me that $10 back. I said, oh man, it was like my sponsor had said, pass it on. So this guy was going to rehab, so I gave him $10 for while he was in rehab. And 3 or 4 months later, he gave me that $10 back. It's like, what am I? It was like, ooh, you know, I just felt so guilty every time it came my way. It started multiplying. The first time it multiplied, it was $40. I'd given away four times, and all of a sudden, $40 passed my hand. And I knew when I got that $40 from an unexpected source that it was that $10 being multiplied. So I give it away, and I give it away. And the last time that it came back to me, it was in the form of $33,000. And it was an accumulation of several months that it happened, but I knew when everything came in that that's what it was. I went to those meetings, and this cowboy, I finally told him where I was going, and because he was out of town most of the time when I was doing this, and I finally told him where I was going and why, and he didn't know what I was talking about, literally. And then shortly thereafter, he started noticing some changes in me, and they told me that he would. And he started getting a little nasty about me going, and pretty soon he was trying to stop me from going, and pretty soon we were in fights over it. And I mean, again, this terrible violence that happens in alcoholism. He would scream and yell and threaten me and try to keep me from going to meetings. And after I'd been there for a year, he came and got sober for 6 months. And then after 6 months, he went to our first convention. He heard a lot of speakers, great caliber speakers. And when we got home, he decided he wasn't really, really an alcoholic, and he went back to drinking. And he drank for the next 26 years. I stayed with him for 7 years, and I was getting better all this time, and he was getting worse. And the violence stopped the minute I come into this program and listening to what y'all told me to do, and I did everything you told me to do. I did balk, but I didn't let you know I balked. I just did it. And he came in one night after 7 years and started beating me up. And as I fell over the foot of the bed, and this had just been a matter of seconds, I looked up, and in the door was my children. and they were just dancing a little jig and screaming, and my son was, "Daddy, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't." He's just a little bitty thing. And it was like scales fell from my eyes. I saw my kids for the very first time ever. And I looked at them and I thought, my God, they know. And they got in here so quick. They're hurting. Look at their faces. And I swear to you, it was the first time that it occurred to me that those kids were hurting because of all this. 7 years later. Tell you what a hot shot speaker you got tonight. I'm so dumb and slow. You know, it's like, 7 years. And I got those kids and we escaped. Now, I'm a high school dropout. I have absolutely no education. And I can't support these kids by myself. And I don't know what to do. And I go to my sponsor and we pray. And she's a praying woman. I mean, she just used to embarrass me. I mean, she'd pray in front of people. It's like... And I was always so embarrassed for her. And but drop a hat, she'd pray. And so we just hit our knees and prayed about what I was supposed to do. And absolutely, the next thing I knew, it just unfolded right before my eyes. I became a nurse. Now, I never dreamed about it being a nurse. I never wanted to be a nurse. I didn't care about it being a nurse. I get car sick, and I kept thinking bedpans. Oh, man. And next thing I knew, I was enrolled in nursing school. And it was absolutely awesome. I mean, I was the top of my class. And I always thought I was so dumb. I always thought I was stupid, dumb, couldn't learn. And I graduated and top of my class. We had a big graduation ceremony, and they'd asked me to give the class response. And I got up and was thanking this huge crowd. Most of them was my people. You know, this whole front section was all the AAs and Al-Anon in my little group, and my sponsor had moved down to Austin, and she flew in to surprise me to be at the graduation. And right in the middle of all them was my mama and my daddy. And they were looking up at me, and my daddy was crying, and my next-door neighbor was next to him. And I'll never forget this. I looked down, and I was thanking the families for staying with us and helping us, and my daddy turned down to the next-door neighbor, and he pointed his finger, and he said, "That's my kid up there." And I'll just never forget that. You know, and they had been so ashamed of me, and Mother was crying, and it was great. And God took that. It's been, every speaker, I think, has mentioned, every time there's this black hole in our life, God can turn that around and make something good of it and make it a blessing. And my nursing skills became a blessing because my dad died of cancer, and I was the one that was able to take care of him and give him the dignity that he needed to die. And he died a wonderful, precious little death. And I started working in this nursing home. I was a director of nurses, so I could set up these things. There was people on welfare there, and I knew how they felt because to get through school, I had to go through welfare, and I had to go to Texas Rehab, and a bunch of the men got together and gave me, each one of them was responsible for $100, and they gave me $1,000, which was a lot of money back then, to get through school. And I would just carry it through school, and I knew what it was like to be on welfare and take food stamps, and I wanted their dignity upheld. And so I created a system in our little area that you would not know who was on welfare and who wasn't, so that everybody was treated equal, because you could see the difference in the treatment they received. And the people who come in and inspect that stuff saw my system, and they liked it, and they picked it up, and it went all over the state of Texas. And it's because one person was humiliated, or thought she was, by being on welfare. And God can take it and make it something beautiful. I was able to use my nursing skills many, many times for my family and make those living amends. I did go to my parents, needless to say, and face-to-face and cleaned up all that stuff. And it took my mom a long time to forgive me, let me tell you. She just didn't jump in my arms. But I was told and did go by there every Saturday for at least 10 minutes. And then I made it 15, and then pretty soon I was invited for supper, and pretty soon the kids and I went, and then we were back in good graces with my family, all except my one brother. I had a brother named Jimmy who he didn't speak to me for 26 years. He did not speak to me once, and he would totally ignore me. He'd be in the room where I was at. He'd walk right past me. He wouldn't look at me. My children weren't welcome in his home. When my dad died, my mother went off to Austin. My other two brothers went to Austin. We were not invited, and it was left. Me and my children were left there. My dad died in November, just a few weeks before Christmas. Mother said, "I'm sorry, I just can't stay here." And I said, "I understand that." And it was just me and my two kids. And man, I mean, it was a miserable time. And I was invited to so many AA families' homes that Christmas. I remember I had so many invitations I couldn't fulfill them, but I just stayed at home. And Christmas Eve about 10, I mean, bang, 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 and went to the door, and here was my drunk ex-husband by this time. And the kids were just so excited to see him, and we all were. And he was so drunk, and he came in, and I was pleased to see him. Very pleased. My kids were excited, and it was just a peace that came over me that we could share this, because I thought, my God, he hadn't had anybody in years, and I hadn't even thought about him at all, being alone at Christmas. And so he came in, and we shared Christmas, and it was pretty neat. And I started working in this business, and I was just fulfilled and had a lot of self-worth, and I was doing really great, and my daughter started quacking. They say that only an alcoholic can call themselves an alcoholic, but I heard a man from a podium say, if looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and waddles like a duck, chances are it's a duck. And if you're looking at an alcoholic who's waddling and quacking, probably an alcoholic. And I looked at my daughter, and she's quacking a lot. So we started having those visits, and pulling her out of cars and making her stay in home and grounding her. You know, grounding is such a fun thing, isn't it? You're grounded. And then she could go through walls. I've never seen anything like it in my life. I could stand at her door with a pistol, and she'd still get out of that room. I never have figured out how she did that. And we fought a lot, and it just wound up I hated her and she hated me. The phone rang, and I just didn't even want to answer it. And it was difficult. And she ran away from home when she was in high school, and I was glad she was gone. It was just so heavy on me, I just couldn't take it. I mean, I just fought it, and I fought it, and I fought it, and I tried and tried and tried to make something out of it, and it was just too tough. It was tougher than I was. And then, if you flip it over, at that time at night when you're all by yourself, and I'm thinking, I feel the guilt of the world. You know, if I hadn't stayed with him, if I'd left here, if I'd done this, if I hadn't done that, blah, blah, blah. I was the Altine sponsor for a few years, and they were going around the room one night talking, and this one kid held his hand up, and he said, I just hate my mama. So the only thing that was wrong with my daddy is he's drunk, and she made him leave. He just drank. He's just drunk, that's all, and she made him leave. And I thought, oh, my God, that's what I did. And then two or three other come around, this kid says, I just hate my mama. My daddy's drunk all over the house, and she won't make him leave. And I thought, isn't this interesting? There is no answer. There is no answer. This is the disease. We all live in it, and it's just Saturday. And I'm going to do the best I can Saturday. And these kids just broke my heart. And so she left, and she was on her way. And my son, they called me from school. He was 11 years old. And they had caught him in a closet with a couple of guys, and they were sniffing Pam, you know, that spraying stuff, through a paper towel holder. Pam, for God's sakes. I mean, I can smell whiskey and I can understand beer, but Pam? And I scooped him up and went straight to the doctor and got him all checked out and was coming back home and got him there and said the, you know, asked the question that any good Al-Anon would say, son, why did you do that? And he looked up at me and he said, Mama, I like the way it makes me feel. Yeah, I did too. Oh, no. So I knew what I had to do. I was not, do you hear me? I was not going to have this child be an alcoholic. Michelle. I was going to do something different this time, and I was going to nip this in the bud, and it wasn't going to happen. He was just not going to do it. And so I got with some people in the program, and we were going to put him in a boys' ranch in San Angelo, Texas, and I was going to move down there, and he was going to be put away with some guidance and some men, and it was going to be great. And I was in the process of getting that done, and his drunk daddy came and kidnapped him one night, and I didn't know where he was for a couple of days, and had the sheriff out looking for him. Was fixed to put his picture on the milk carton, and he called one night. He said, Mama, I'm okay. I'm with my daddy, and this is where I really want to be. I'm not coming home. And I was just devastated. After all I had done for these children, and them turn on me like that and go with that drunk, and I was just, ooh. And then the guilt sets in, and I went to my sponsor, and I was a mess, of course. And she wanted me to write an inventory on my motherhood, which I did. And in that inventory, I realized a couple of things that were just marvelous. Number one, God has no grandchildren. He just doesn't. He loves those kids the exact same depth that He does me. And that all of us live in the disease of alcoholism. I had Al-Anonism. They were probably both alcoholics. Their daddy was, both daddies were alcoholics. And there's just no blame in that stuff. That's just the way it is. And everybody did the very best they could on any given day. And then I realized some things that I really did do good as a mother. There was things that I did do for those kids. And I tried to protect them from alcoholism. And I did feed them, and I did bathe them, and I did see that they got to school. And I had to weigh this stuff out. And I had to forgive myself for being who and what I am. The big book says an alcoholic has to concede in their innermost self that they are an alcoholic. And at that time, I conceded in my innermost self that I was an Al-Anon. I had this disease, and that it spewed over on my children, and that we were all very sick, and we were doing the best we could do. She said for me to go into prayer and meditation and put these kids in God's hands. She said, think of some place that you really feel good that y'all were at. And we had started going to church by this time. And one Sunday, we went down. There was a kneeling rail, and you knelt, and the elders of the church came and prayed for you, whatever your request was. And this Sunday, I was in the middle, and both kids were on the side of me. And we were holding hands, and we were praying for the daddy's sobriety. And I remembered that day, how warm and good I felt, and how the kids, they smiled when we got through. So in my prayer meditation, I took them down to that rail and put their hands together, and I stepped off and left them in God's hand. And what that did to me, what my sponsor said it would do, it would take the worry away about my children. Not necessarily the concern, because I'd always be concerned about my children, but it would take the worry away. And it did. I felt much, much at peace with that, that they had their path, and I could not get on their path. They have a path. I have a path. And if I have to get down on mine and get on their path, one of us is going to get knocked off. And so just let them go on their path and me stay on mine. And I can do that only one day at a time. And I'm a spring jumper, so I can jump over there anytime. I was alone, and these two kids were doing what they were doing, and I conceded that my son was going to live with his dad. That's where he wanted to be. My daughter was off doing her deal, and I was kind of enjoying it, to tell you the truth. And spending money on myself and going to conventions and having a good time with my AA family. And I met this man from California. His name was Jim Shaw. And he was the cutest thing I'd ever seen. His big old blue eyes, gray hair. He was so distinguished looking, and he had lots of diamonds. That really got my attention. And we started having a long-distance relationship, and we decided that I would move out to California and get a place, and we'd see if we could put a marriage together. So I quit my job, put all my stuff that I was going to keep in a U-Haul trailer and gave the rest of it away and went off to speak at a convention and told them how joyful God was if you just follow the path, see what happens to you, and the rewards I was getting, and I was going off to California and da-da-da-da-da. And I got home, and he was waiting at the plane for me in Lubbock. He'd flown in from California, and he said he'd gotten in touch with his feelings. Oh, please. And then he couldn't go through with it. And after much examining and talking about it a long time later, he was just a coward. And if you're single, girls, if you got an alcoholic on tow, let me tell you, they are the biggest scaredy cats in this whole wide world. Just don't pay attention to them. Just keep shoving and pushing, and you'll get them. I mean, I don't mean to offend you alcoholics, but y'all are cowards. I'm sorry. So I had some actions right after that I really, really, really would not ever tell you if my sponsor didn't tell me to. I would never tell you this. I want you all to think I'm a spiritual giant. I was so angry at God, not at Jim, but at God, because I had been, you know, why did he lay something this beautiful out in front of me and then yank it away? What's the deal? I had done everything y'all said to do. I made the coffee. I set up the chairs. I took commitments. I sponsored people. I was sponsored. I was the GR, for God's sake. And if you go that far, I mean, you've really gone the whole schmoo. And this is what I was getting. You know, and people say the same thing. Well, that's another learning experience. Well, crap, I'm as smart as I want to be. I God loves you, and there's da 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 and da da da, and you know, I just want to go, you know, just full of anger. And it wasn't at them, and it wasn't at Jim, it was at God. And just, what's the deal? I mean, just blamed him for everything. And in my head, to get back at him was to hurt. See, because I'm vindictive, and I want you to know how bad you've hurt me. So I went and got some of his kids and really tried to screw him up real good. I got some newcomer alcoholics who were trying to get sober, and I just took them off to my house. And, you know, I'm just so ashamed of that I don't know what to do. It still hurts me because one of them never came back. And you know, 13th stepping, this is no place for 13th stepping because people's lives depend on us. And one of them snitched to my sponsor. He was a in-and-out guy, so he knew my sponsor. And so he told her that this other guy was, and it was like snitch. But I got in trouble. She sat me down and started talking to me, and then she made me go tell her husband, Jack, which I had rather do anything than go tell Jack what I've been doing, because Jack was my hero. He was just everything to me. So I told him what I had done, and he really looked at me with complete disdain. He said, "No, tall gal, we don't do that here. Lives." He said, "If you're going to mess around like that, go outside of AA, because lives are saved here. We don't 13th step here. It's not the place. And you'll never be a winner if you do that. And all you're going to do is hurt other people." And I hurt him. And I have not ever even thought about it since then. You know, your sobriety and my serenity is much more important to me than, you know, rolling the hay, let me tell you. And I can't fix anything. Trying to use you as my fix, it just doesn't work. So I started praying, and I wrote an inventory on it. My sponsor always gives me assignments, and I wrote this inventory, and I was coming back from a conference just a few weeks after that, and was driving, and it was Sunday afternoon, and it was so clear to me as a bell. God had given me, I'd already had everything anybody wants. God had given me a home, children, love, laughter, life, a way out. He'd given me everything, and I didn't need anything else ever in my life. If I never, ever had another man in my life, I was overpaid, and I just felt this tremendous gratitude. Now, all I want to do is go back to my meeting and set up the chairs, because a lot of people in that meeting that are very unhappy with me and my shenanigans, I'll tell you, as they should have been. If you ever should have been asked to leave the program, I should have been asked to leave, because I was hurting a lot of people. And all I want to do is just go back there and just let me sit here and just let me be a part of it. And I'll tell you, I have not changed that attitude to this day. If you'll just let me do whatever I can do, I really, really want to do it. Because my life, I'm so overpaid, it's unbelievable. And I'm so glad God gives mercy, not justice. And I walked through this, and about the time I did, Jim Shaw came back into my life, of course. You know, God's such a good God. He had lessons learned, and I had, and he put us back together. And we got married, and we were going to be Mr. and Miss Al-Anon. I'd seen y'all come in, you know, you couples, you'd come in, you're just so cute, and y'all'd leave, you're just so cute. I just thought that way every couple was. I didn't know what happened in the car on the way to and the way from. And we had to hammer out a good marriage, and we did. We were married and lived in Oklahoma, where he's from, and he had a lot of money. I was rich for about 30 minutes, and I loved it. And the all bus came, and we lost everything. We moved to Dallas for a while, and we went back out to California. Clancy was his sponsor and told him to come back. And so we went back out to California. In the meantime, my daughter had called. She had tried to commit suicide, and she was drunk, and I left her be. I'd had enough of y'all helping me to know that she needed to be left alone. A few short months after that, I went back to Lubbock, my hometown, as I did at that time every year for homecoming, and she came to meet me to spend a little time with me, and she sat in the meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, and when they asked for newcomers, she raised her hand, and she got 10 years of sobriety, and it was absolutely marvelous. I was so absolutely thrilled. At the same time, a couple of months later, Jim's daughter showed up here. She had been out there on the streets, bad drunk. She had a child out of wedlock, a little cute little boy, and she came back, and we helped raise that boy for a couple of years. And she is in AA, and she's doing extremely well. And my daughter met another young man on AA campus, and they got pregnant, they got married, they had baby, they got divorced, me and Jim got they. And I loved what Polly said, and I agree 100%. You know, I was a lousy mother, but boy, I'm a great grandma. I'm a great grandma. Jim was a great grandpa. I just loved to watch him with those kids. He went to school, and he would take pumpkins and
carve them out at pumpkin time for my granddaughter and the kids. And he would dress up in a Santa Claus suit and go down there at Christmas. And he would, we even got him an Easter costume, and he went down Easter. And he was the cutest. He was short and fat. He was the cutest thing you ever saw. And he loved his grandkids. And he did that for all the grandkids. And it was a sweet time. And Tracy had 10 years of sobriety, and we gave her a great big huge party. And I found out right before that she sent this little girl back to the daddy to live. And he lived in, still does, in Vermont. And we were in California at this time, and I was just devastated. We were such a part of my granddaughter's life. And then right after that, she tried to commit suicide sober. And she was doing all the things. All the things. But she was in one of those periods, I think Don said it so wonderful today. I just got to listen to your tape a thousand times. You said so much stuff that my head just swam with it. You were just magnificent. And your heritage touched my heritage that I know nothing about. And it was real. I was so impressed. But the seasons, I think she was in one of those seasons and didn't realize it was just a season. And she tried to kill herself. And shortly after that, of course, she drank. She got 2.5 years sober again. She had 90 days the second time. And I got a call from my son and my cowboy husband. They put his hand in a machine and nearly cut it off, or his arm rather, and nearly bled to death. And they had stuck him in a hospital. And he was living in a warehouse on a cot for this man, just watching his warehouse. And the man would give him enough whiskey to keep him alive. And that was his life. And he was going to die. And Jim said, why don't you go back and 12-step your dad, and gave her the money for a ticket. She went back and 12-stepped the little cowboy, and it took. 26 years later, he got sober. He had 4 years of sobriety, and he died last January. And me and my kids went back and buried his man. And it was like I made amends. He had the cutest little funeral you ever saw. I went and got an old antique box because he just didn't go in a chrome box. We put him in a pine box, and I went and got some hay and decorated the hay and got his rope and made some little cute. He was just the cutest little funeral. I was so proud. And all the cowboys come and say, would you do my funeral? That's what I want. And me and the kids, we all wore the little red bandanas, and we all dressed in black, and we had his favorite cowboy songs. And it was, I mean, me and my children buried their dad, and it was like making amends, the whole family. And it was a really precious time. It truly was. But anyway, she got sober. She was sober 2.5 years. And she called me one night. She had moved over to Phoenix. And she said, are you sitting down? And I said, what? You know, are you sitting down? An alcoholic calls you at 10 o'clock at night. Are you sitting down, please? You know, this ain't going to be a good conversation. She said, I just ran off to Las Vegas and got married. I said, to who? And she wasn't even dating anybody that I knew. Well, she met this lovely cowboy when we were home for Christmas. They'd talked to each other on the phone and saw each other twice, and they ran off and got married. And, of course, he was still drinking. But he was going to go AA. And I said, oh, well, good. Are y'all going to live there in Phoenix or go to Texas or what? She said, well, we got to hurry up and get back to Texas before his parole officer finds out he's out of state. So I was endeared to my son-in-law right off the bat. And I was going to talk in Dallas, Texas. Polly was there. And she called me. My daughter called me. And she said, we were talking at, what was it, an anniversary, I guess. And she said, Mom, I'm going to be up there in Dallas this weekend, and I just need to tell you something to prepare yourself. She said, I just got out of the emergency room. I've been there all night. I've been drunk. And I've been beat up. And I look pretty bad. And I said, thank you, and I'll see you. And I just hung up. And I'm so glad that I've been trained to do what I do, and it's pick up the phone as soon as you get it down and call your sponsor. I mean, that's all I know to do, because I'm not smart enough to make decisions. And I called my sponsor, and she told me some things to do. And, you know, right immediately the guilt just pours all over me. I just do that. It's just a knee-jerk reaction. I'm going home, and I'm going to get me a bracelet, and it's going to say pause on it. We've been all of us, a bunch of us, a while ago, pausing. And I think that's so cool. And I really hated to see her. I just hated to see her. I just saw myself, but I absolutely had to release her to whatever she had to do. And she's sober again. One of the guys in our group busted her. He said, I know what you've been doing, blah, 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 the Ben Show. And He's her sponsor now, and she's got 2 years of sobriety again. Vince and I went down to San Diego, where she is now. She travels a lot. And we gave her a 2-year chip the other night, and she just, it's different. You know, that there's the eyes are there, the recovery's there, and it's just incredible. 4 years ago, Jim and I were doing so well in California. We bought a home in Palm Springs. It was paid for. We were going to retire out there. And I had knee surgery, so I was out there recuperating. And he came out there. He was going to start a second little business and give this business to our business manager and foreman. And we were going to be, we were just set for life. It was great. And he got hurt one night in his shoulder and took him to the emergency room, and they took x-rays. He had cancer, and he was dead in 3 months. And it was just, of course, needless to say, I was just so shocked. And that last week when I was trying to get some information from the business manager, discovered that we'd been embezzled and that I had nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. And one of the last memories of my husband that I have was him on the telephone begging this young woman to give me the computer and help me get this thing straightened up. He was just begging her. And I, you know, I just never will forget that. It's still in my heart. It still hurts. And I hope I never see her again, because I don't know what I'll do. I think I'd take the bracelet off and throw it. And I found myself in just, you know, a mess. And I went to see Clancy and laid it all out in front of him. And he said, you know, I don't ever tell anybody to file bankruptcy, because we always work our way out of that. He said, but I don't see that you have any choice. And so he called a guy that he sponsored, who's an attorney. Many of you know him, Clint Hodges, and he helped me, and I got bankruptcy done. And I'll tell you, that hurt me just as much, if not more, than Jim dying, because his word, his honesty in this fellowship was something he wore with honor, and he worked real hard at it. And I felt so bad. But there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. But one more time, you take those things and you change them. And I help women that I sponsor now. You know what's going on. You know everything. He had 3 different insurance policies, and they were all accidental. I guess he thought he was going to live forever. And so I had no insurance. I lost my house. I lost everything. And in that period of time is when I got that $33,000. People from all over sent money. And it's like Polly mentioned this morning, when one of us is wounded, I mean, y'all just gathered me up. You paid for my husband's funeral, and you helped me move. You helped me keep that house for 6 months. And God, you just did everything in the world for me, and my life is yours. You know, whatever you need, it's yours. I'll never forget the loneliness that I felt and how scared I was. And y'all never left me alone for months, for months. You were with me every moment, carrying me, and it was just an incredible time. 3 months later, I got a message that my nephew was drunk out on the oil rig outside of Houston and got crushed to death. And we went down and did that funeral. And then a few months later, my stepdad of 20 years died. And 3 months after that, my mama died. I had 11 deaths in, 4 deaths in 11 months. And then we closed down my mama's house of 35 years, and it was gone in 3 weeks. It's gone. Sold everything. And I went back to California. I stayed there, and I thought, my God, what happened? What just happened here? It was awful. I moved into a room and with a girl, and I stayed in that room for a couple of years. And then I was given a gift of an apartment for a year. And I've had that apartment for a year, and that year was just up. And it was like, okay, God, it's me and you. It's been me and you the years up, and I don't know. I just didn't make enough. I just got this little part-time job nearly to live, and I didn't know where I was going to go. And another friend owns a house in L.A., and she's in AA, and she's in New York teaching, and she's going to be there for several years. My friend Rita was taking care of the house for her and just paying minimal, the mortgage. It's like 30 years old, so it's nothing, especially for California. It is nothing. Rita's engaged, so she's going to move out of this house, and Diane and Rita said, do you want this house? It's a house. It's a 2-bedroom house, and it happened to come available just as my apartment I was losing. It just so happened. And I said, well, that's great, but I don't make enough money to do it. And then I thought, well, God's done everything else. I'm just going to step out on faith. So I just took it and started moving in. About that time, it just so happens that my company in Los Angeles shut the doors, and the Chicago company took it over. They have a whole different policy, and that I got more money, more commission, more expenses. It's just the exact amount of money to take care of this house and this home. They just all happen at the same time. Isn't that something? I mean, God takes care of me if I just let it happen, and it's the most incredible thing. He's taken care of me ever since Jim died. I just thought I was going to, be walking, pushing a basket on the seashore out there. Jim taught me how so many wonderful things. I just loved him. My sponsor had me do two papers the other day. One of them was Broken Relationships, and the other was Five Heroes. And Jim was on there as one of my heroes because he was so dedicated and so much in love with life. He just loved alcoholics better than anybody ever saw him. And he just had fun when he was dying. He really did. I mean, they made jokes, and we set out Palm Springs, and they were sneaking him out the back door to play golf because I wouldn't let him go like a little kid. And they were sneaking, going, by the house. And it was just an incredible time. And he said to me and to other people, he said, we live here by these steps. And the 11th step says that we ask the knowledge for his will and the power to carry it out. And he said, I guess his will for me right now is going to heaven, and he's giving me the power to do it. And he said, don't you worry. It's going to be all right. And one night I was crying in the middle of the night, and he got up and he came in there, and he said, what are you crying about? And I said, I'm just going to miss you so much. I was crying. And he said, well, you want me to figure out a way to take you with me? I'm not going to miss you that much, Jim. And it was really sweet. It was a really incredible time, and I know he's in heaven and having a good time up there. One of the guys he's with is one of my other heroes, and this is my story that I always close with. It's Bob White. Bob White was a giant in Texas. He just was sober forever, and just a great man. He'd kiss men right in the mouth. He'd just get them, smack them, call them sugar babe, smack them, just he'd scare them to death. And big old cowboy. And we started a conference at his insistence called the Canyon Conference. It's in Oklahoma, down in a canyon, and he was the first Sunday morning speaker, and it came to be his last talk, because right shortly thereafter he had cancer, and I was able to go and take care of him when he's dying. But this morning he said, we close every meeting with the Lord's Prayer, and it starts off with Our Father, and there's a part in there that says the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. So if it's any school kid would know, if there's a father and it's a king, that makes you and I a child of the king. So we are royalty. We are prince and princess. He said, so claim your heritage and use the power which is in this room. The glory, of course, is God's. And he said, be who you are. And as he was saying that, I thought, I am going to claim that. I am. I always had trouble with my self-worth, and this is it. I know who I am. I am Princess Vinoy, and I'm a child of the king. And that's the heritage that you have given me. You're my family, and thank you so much for my life.